Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And this week, we're marking the end of our third season with another two-part deep dive into an actual, real-life, bona fide, proper Beatles film starring the actual Beatles. Although not really properly, at least not until the end, because this episode's film is on 1968's Yellow Submarine, a movie that Wikipedia describes as an animated jukebox musical fantasy comedy adventure film, which probably just about covers it, although it leaves out surreal, psychedelic, and as mad as a box of marmalade skies. Upon release, it fulfilled the Beatles' contractual obligation with United Artists for three movies after A Hard Day's Night and Help. And while it didn't set the box office alight, it quickly garnered a huge cult following and has since been cited as a huge influence on modern-day filmmakers and animators. But how does it fare today? Is it just for kids? Just for Beatles fans? Just for kid Beatles fans? Or is it one of the earliest forms of mainstream pop art pushing the boundaries of the medium at the same time as expanding the limits of your own imagination? We're not going to be blue meanies about this. It's pretty great, isn't it?
It is pretty great. Yeah. I really remember one of my fondest. I don't have many fond memories of the first COVID-19 lockdown in 2020. But I had to look this up, actually. It was on the 25th of April 2020. So here in the UK, we were about a month into our first proper lockdown, proper you can only go outside for an hour every day, if that, lockdown. And it was announced on social media that there was going to be a screening of Yellow Submarine. They were going to do a YouTube live stream of it, and it was on 25th of April. I was really looking forward to it, because, you know, like, you remember that time, like, just anything that cut through the boredom, anything that made your day even slightly different, you really, really looked forward to, you know. So I did for days. And then when it happened, I remember it being like quite a nice sunny day, and it felt quite joyous. It felt communal. I remember sort of seeing, I will never ever look at comments on a live YouTube stream. I mean, why would you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that way madness lies. But just, it just really struck me that, like, everyone watching it was having a sort of joyous communal experience. I thought, of course, it all makes sense. The blue meanies are the virus, and love is the cure, and the Beatles are the syringe. and yes, it makes sense. It all fits. And I thought, as I often do, that maybe the Beatles are the greatest unifying cultural force that the human race has. So yeah, it's pretty good.
I hated it. No, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I wish I had been a part of that. That sounds lovely. My experience of Yellow Submarine is watching it as a kid at that time in the '80s, when every now and again it was one of those films that might be shown on one of the four channels we had back in those days. And I remember kind of watching it, knowing that my parents were Beatles fans, and therefore it should hold some kind of significance, but just thinking it was a bit weird. In the same way that sometimes things that I felt were quite old and dated to me as a 7-year-old kid or however old I was, felt. I deliberately haven't watched it again until now. So that's the cover of this episode. I don't mean I deliberately haven't watched it since I was 7, knowing full well that one day I might be a co-host on a Beatles podcast. But when it came up, I wanted to revisit it, and I deliberately haven't until now, just so I could be fresh with brand new opinions for this. But it's an interesting watch, because I think that it's a strange thing to think about this film potentially being for kids.
Yeah.
And as a kid, it didn't really gel with me. As a Beatles fan, and as a someone who considers himself knowledgeable about films and writes about films, I felt like I was really able to appreciate what works in the movie now.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel. Answering that question about who is this film for, when this was released, do we think it was for a younger audience, or was it aimed at the young adult Beatles fan demographic?
I think it was aimed at the young adult Beatles fans demographic, to the extent it was aimed at anyone at all. I mean, so when we spoke about Magical Mystery Tour, which is, of course, their last sort of film project that they'd done at the end of 1967, we spoke a bit about how they didn't particularly seem to be aiming things at an audience particularly anymore. They seemed to be, if not deliberately trying to alienate them, then at least being prepared to alienate them. I think this seems to have come about much more because the filmmakers wanted to do it, and the Beatles said, yeah, sure, go ahead, and then pretty much ignored them. And then at the end watched it and said, hey, this is really good, I like this. Can we record a little bit to go at the end? Fine, yeah, done. And then, like, 3 weeks later, sodded off to Rishikesh and forgot about it. I think it's one of those things that by accident has been one of the main things that has preserved their longevity for as long as it has, in that it is probably one of the main ways that children get into the Beatles. As you did, I never watched it as a kid, actually. It was never on TV, or at least I never saw it on TV. And I think I probably would have wanted to buy it on VHS and couldn't. So I don't think I saw it until I was late teens, early 20s, something like that. But lots and lots of people, particularly in America, it seems like, have that experience of having watched it. It was on the TV a lot in the 70s and the 80s. I think in America, it seems to have been on like a big sort of holiday film, like sort of Memorial Day weekend or whatever it is. It would sort of always be on TV, and lots of people seem to have that memory. And so I think there's lots of people who grew up watching it, and maybe their first experience of the Beatles was as a child watching them in a cartoon, and the songs are sort of quite accessible in that sense. And so I think, like, quite by accident, these days, these big multimedia conglomerates like Disney will sort of have these specific marketing strategies of, so, you know, like Disney Plus, the streaming service, good example. So on that, If you have kids, there's stuff on there for your kids. If you're an adult, there's stuff on there, and things like the Star Wars and Marvel things are kind of aimed at both audiences, and so they're like quite cannily have like the same product that can be marketed to two demographics at the same time. Yellow Submarine is that product, but completely by accident. Like, no one was trying to come up with a marketing strategy that said, oh, this will keep kids watching it for years and years and years, because nobody was even thinking in those terms, you know.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because I still struggle a little bit with the idea of kids watching this film and really engaging with it.
Yeah.
Because we talk a lot about some of the films that we cover in this podcast as movies being a product of their time, and this does feel like that. right? Like, this is very much a snapshot of a particular artistic movement and creative revolution, if you will. And it kind of encapsulates that quite neatly. Those things aren't necessarily what is conducive for a good viewing experience for a child.
Yeah.
But I think what does happen in this movie and watching it is there is so much stuff happening on screen. I was watching this being like, obviously it's a story, it's a weird story. And the very first note I made on my phone while I was watching this film is, well, this animation is a bit freaky deaky, isn't it? Right?
That's the whole podcast, really, isn't it? Like, you know, what more do you need?
Exactly, yeah. Revered film writer here. I kind of felt like, well, what is in it for kids? And actually, I think what's in it is it plays to sort of your, it plays to like shorter attention spans quite well, I think, because there is so much happening on screen. It's just filled with imagination, like filled to the brim and beyond of weird things happening with sharp jaws, chests, and, you know, big powerful gloves in the sky flying around and laughing at people and, you know, all those kind of things. And I can imagine kids watching that and then wanting to watch it again, and because it's you're seeing a thousand different routes into an untapped part of your imagination every single time you watch it.
That's very appealing to a child, isn't it?
Yeah. Right?
Like that whole idea of because I suppose, you know, you're a man with two young children. I suppose there are certain films that you have watched over and over again to accommodate
absolutely.
Them. You
know? Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
Nightmare on Elm Street, for example, you know.
And a lot of the films that they will watch will be things like Pixar movies. Mm. But I don't think that my young kids would watch Yellow Submarine and A, root for the Beatles to save the day, like B, understand the menace or the peril that the Blue Meanies present.
Yeah.
Understand any of the sequences that happen throughout the film in terms of going through the sea of time and all of the sea of holes and all of those parts of the movie. But I do think they'll like the music, and I think that they will love this weird and wonderful rainbow coming out of top hats, you know, these sequences of animated countdowns, for example. And every 30 seconds there's a new thing that I think would capture their imaginations and be like, oh, that's something I've never seen or thought of or even imagined was possible to witness before.
And I think you can imagine that the it makes it sort of more rewatchable. You see and discover different stuff just by looking at a different bit of the screen every time you watch it. So I think that, like, you're right that it's sort of representative of the psychedelic era, but I don't think it's not a coincidence necessarily that children can appreciate that. I think there's a lot of psychedelia, the psychedelic movement, was to do with being childlike or accepting the childlike part of yourself. You think of songs like See Emily Play and things like that, which is sort of feel like they're sort of based around nursery rhymes. You know, there's a kind of simplicity to it, which can sound sort of quite eerie in one context. But I think that if you take like a massive sort of psychedelic wig out, that it's all, you know, like the Doors completely freaking out, then no, that your kids are probably not going to go for it all that much. But the sort of more playful elements of it, you can completely see how a child would appreciate, you know.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And I think that the other thing I have found, again, with two young children is the type of film that is guaranteed to keep their attention more than any other is a film that has musical numbers in.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that this film is presented as a musical, because that's not really... We talked before about when we covered Help in our two-parter at the end of our first season, about how songs became part of the plot in an almost contrived way.
Yeah.
You know, there was a story, and then every now and again, the band would stop and play a song.
Mm.
Whereas these are animated sequences designed around the songs. And each song has kind of like its own section within the film.
Yeah.
And in that way, it feels like it's a, you know, the term musical jukebox, as Wikipedia very rightly points out, feels like it's a no-brainer for the Beatles have done something like that, but actually this is the first time we see anything like that, and possibly the only other Beatles musical jukebox that exists outside of Across the Universe, which we've again covered in a previous episode.
Yeah, I think, yeah, Yellow Submarine is the Beatles' only musical. Yeah, so to draw that distinction, like when we talk about a musical, we're talking about a film in which the characters break into song, and that is part of the narrative, if you like. So there are problems they come across that are solved through song. People have conversations in a way through song. It's not that they're trying to make out that the exact words being sung are being said, but it moves the plot along. So Help is not a musical. Help is a film about the Beatles, who are a band, and during the film they perform songs because they are a band, and that's their job.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's not a musical in that sense. Everyone in the film is aware that they are playing songs, and they watch them play the songs, and then that's the end of the song, and then they get on with the film. Like Yellow Submarine is a musical in sort of truer sense of the word, and it's built around the songs for sure. Which it's kind of interesting, given that the songs that the Beatles presented for it were kind of offcuts, really. They were sort of stuff they'd recorded for Sgt. Pepper and B-sides and things like that. Yeah. Maybe they certainly. Hey Bulldog was a song I think that came about because they had to go into the studio to record. It was sort of music video for Lady Madonna, which I guess would have been shortly before they went to Rishikesh, because Lady Madonna was released, I think, while they were in Rishikesh. So just so they could be filmed in the studio to provide some, you know, like a video for it. While they were there, they thought, well, we've got half a song here, let's turn it into a song. And they finished off and recorded Hey Bulldog in that. And so there's now a YouTube video where you can go and watch, and it's all been synced up, and you can see they are actually singing that song. Mm. But whether they were doing that specifically for the film, I don't know.
That's an interesting one. I guess my impression from what I've read up about the film is that's not the case. It was, what have you got that you can offer us? I think there was a contractual obligation for them to present four songs that hadn't been released.
Yeah.
So those four songs are Count Them With Me, Only a Northern Song.
Yep. Hey Bulldog.
Hey Bulldog.
It's All Too Much.
And All Together Now.
Yep.
Yeah. Only a Northern Song was originally recorded for Sgt. Pepper's.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, again, this is what I've read up, but it was one of the first songs I think they started to record. No one really liked it. Sorry, George. And I read somewhere, I think it might have come from George Martin, but I read somewhere that they were trying to record the song. They didn't really get on board with recording the song, didn't really like it very much. And it was when George Harrison presented Within Without You that there were huge sighs of relief around. And interestingly, I think when they finished mixing Sgt. Pepper, they then went back to that original recording and finished off Only Northern Song. And I think there's, in some kind of extract, Mark Lewisohn has said that it showed like a, almost like a voracious appetite to get back to recording again, like even having completed an album and through to a final mix, to then be like, let's go back to that other one that we started and didn't like and finish it off. This idea that they just were overflowing with creativity, and they just wanted to get back on the horse again straight away. There seems to be conflicting opinions about Only a Northern Song.
Yeah.
What do you think of it?
It was one I sort of discovered quite late because of like not seeing the film. And it's also not one of the Yellow Submarine, the soundtrack album, is not one of the albums the CDs that you go out and buy first when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably the one you get last. Whether I actually ever even bought the CD, I can't remember. Yeah, so I think, that and It's All Too Much were songs that I sort of filed under, like, psychedelia brackets general. do you know what I mean? They weren't favourites of mine. I like them a lot more now. I like the fact that it's deliberately discordant in places where he talks about the chords going wrong and they kind of do go wrong.
You know? I think I agree with you. Only a Northern Song I've kind of always had a bit of a problem with, because, you know, when you start writing a song about the song that you're writing, it feels a little bit GCSE music. You know, I'm going to try and come up with a really clever creative idea that no one's come up with before.
Yeah.
It also, it does speak of that problematic reputation George has, such as being a bit of a moany old git, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of file it under Psychedelic General, I kind of file it under he's not getting enough money again, like a lot of Taxman.
Right. Yeah.
Which is absolutely, of course, 100% okay and understandable.
Yeah, of course.
But it's a song, a bit like Taxman for me, as brilliant a song as it is, I listen to that and I feel like I'm listening to someone with a massive chip on their shoulder.
Yeah.
And I think that's my listening experience of Only Northern Song as well. It feels like someone who's complaining in song form. however, what I've come to appreciate about the song is lyrically towards the end, he kind of calls into question, you know, this idea of, it doesn't matter what chords I play, it's only a Northern song, because he's basically saying, doesn't matter what I do, Northern Song own the rights. None of my input really matters. But lyrically towards the end of the song, he almost sort of starts to turn that into a bit more of an existential idea, you know, like, who am I, where am I? Like, and I kind of, you could kind of put that in the same category as Nowhere Man, in terms of that's actually some quite mature thinking that has gone into some of the lyrics there. So I kind of can appreciate that actually there's some maturity there, as well as this relatively childish tantrum-like approach to the song that, you know, initiated it.
Yeah. It's such a wonderful mass of contradictions, George. I mean, as John was, but that, I can never get over just how funny it is, the idea of getting like really into sort of like Indian spiritual practices, and like, you know, this whole thing was like, I'm on my way to a higher plane, and I am divesting myself of this material realm. Also, I'm going to write a song about the publishing company that my two friends have set up to publish their songs, because I don't get as much money as them.
Exactly, yeah.
It's just so brilliantly petulant. And, like, the two things just don't marry up at all, you know. But it's the same as, like, you know, it being into all that and also really into Formula One. Like, they just don't seem to go together, you know. And it's great. That's what I love about him. You know?
I like the idea that having gone on the true path of enlightenment, at the end of that is just him getting more than 0.8%. That to him is what is the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
It's obviously very unfair. I do also think, by the way, that as much as it annoys me a little bit that he's singing about, you know, these are the wrong chords I'm playing, and I do think actually there's a real talent in creating a song that is in tune and in key and a recognisable melody over music that sounds discordant. That's not easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, like anyone can go and bash out four chords that sound horrible together, but like he's managed to make it sound tuneful and out of tune at the same time.
Yeah,
which I think is, you know, is to his credit.
Yeah.
Where do we stand on All Together Now?
I think I probably read Revolution in the Head before I heard All Together Now. And I think Ian MacDonald and Revolution in the Head, I think, describes it as trite enough to have been chanted on English football terraces for years or something like that.
Right.
And then when I eventually heard the song, I thought, I've never heard this on a football terrace. Never heard anyone sing this on a football terrace.
Wonder how many football terraces Ian MacDonald went to.
No. Right, exactly. But also it doesn't, like, I mean, you can see it, the sort of chanting element and the repetitive element of it, it completely suited to football chanting, but it doesn't, but I've never heard it in that context. I mean, also, like, you know, did Ian MacDonald ever see that video of Liverpool fans singing She Loves You in 1964, where they all sing the high note at the same time? It's brilliant. It's just joyous and communal. One of the things about the Beatles, and in particular McCartney's songwriting, is sort of understanding the power of big choruses. You know, so I mean, the songs of theirs and his that are sung on football terraces now include Hey Jude. They play that at Brentford before every game. I think Nottingham Forest have got a habit of playing Mull of Kintyre, and they change the lyrics to be to do with the city ground where they play. But there's a reason why it's easy to do with those songs, and that's because they have an understanding of how communality works, you know, of how a big chorus can kind of inculcate fellow feeling, I suppose. And so, yeah, all together now, like, it's incredibly simple, and it's kind of like a nursery rhyme, really. And also, its lyrics are kind of slightly subverting the nursery rhyme, I suppose. And well, I mean, I say that, but I mean, it may just be that they are designed to rhyme and not do much else, like, you know, chop the tree, look at me, that kind of thing. But the what was it? Yellow, green, brown, red, or whatever the colours are. Can I take my friend to bed? Which is like ever so slightly like, ooh, okay. You know, like, you know, there's something ever so slightly, you know, rude or risque or suggestive in it, you know.
Yeah.
Again, it may have just been designed to rhyme and not much more than
You'd
that.
You'd like to think that they wouldn't just go with the first rhyme that popped into their heads, but who knows, they were so prolific in this period that...
Yeah.
I am a bit of a sucker for the fact that the All Together Now works on two levels. I just like that. I know it's basic, but like the idea of Paul singing All Together Now is like a rousing call to accompany him in the singing the song itself, but also as a calling out of the unifying experience of everyone being, you know, together doing that.
Yeah.
I think you can imagine Paul thinking of that double meaning and being like, that's a good thing to write a song about.
Yeah.
And then coming up with what is just a really simple, big chorus, repetitive, catchy, and it works. That's what it's meant to be, right? It's like, what a nice thing. So, you know, it's in a similar kind of way to All You Need Is Love.
Yeah.
In as an approach to a song, it's like you've just got one core idea at the heart of this to create something that people will have stuck in their head for days afterwards, and it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And the phrase All Together Now is one that children understand.
Yeah.
Because they hear it when they sing together.
Yeah,
you know, in class or whatever it is.
That's true, yeah.
You know, everyone understands it. It's easy. By a weird coincidence, about 2 days ago, I heard like a sort of, quite a young East European child use the phrase All Together Now. And I was like, okay, like he was speaking.
Where were you?
I was. Okay, so
walk us through it.
I was in a pub. I was having a drink of my own, and East European family came in. It was a couple and their child. And I'm going to say the kid was about 8 or something like that. And they spoke very good English. They were speaking English to each other, but English was probably not this kid's first language. And he used the phrase All Together Now at some point when he was talking to his parents. Like in the context of let's sing along, and I realised that this is a phrase that's very it's just very well, like, it makes sense to children, like they will hear this. It is a universally understood command to let's all sing together.
Yes, but also maybe he had a teacher that taught him English through Beatles lyrics.
Yes, yeah. One who went on a road trip to to meet John Lennon in Spain. Who knows?
Call back to an episode a couple of weeks ago. Hey. Let's just very, very quickly cap off these songs and talk about the big hitter, Hey Bulldog.
Yes.
We've had a conversation about this off podcast, if you can believe it. Sometimes we talk without being recorded.
Sometimes.
And I remember saying to you that for some reason, Hey Bulldog seemed to enjoy a second life post the initial release of Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
In sort of like late 90s, early 2000s or so. Where suddenly it seemed to re-enter the public consciousness and everyone was like, oh, this is a banging Beatles song that everyone's forgotten existed. Mm. And it felt like a sort of a rediscovered gem. Mm. And it was only through researching this film, and I had no idea beforehand, that I discovered that the song was actually cut from the US version of the film and was only put back in the film again when it was remastered for a re-release in 1999,
right,
which coincides I think with that period.
Yeah,
you know, like, so in my mind, where suddenly I started hearing Hey Bulldog again, like everyone's saying, was saying, hey, there's a song that existed that sounds like the kind of music that's being released today and it's really good by the Beatles, it probably was because of this re-release of this film, and that's when bigger audiences started discovering it for them for the first time.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it feels like quite a 90s song in a way. Like, it feels like quite a Britpop song.
Mm.
You know, there's a big riff to it. It's one of those riffs that's sort of based on, like, bass notes. So you can imagine a band like the Blue Tones or something. In the same way, it's that song, Solomon Bites the Worm, that's got that big... that riff. You can imagine in a similar context to that, like a Britpop band So it's sort of picking that up. I think Teenage Fan Club did a cover of it at some point, actually.
Oh, wow, really?
Seem to remember. I could be wrong. But yeah, that is... Hey Bulldog's a song I was first introduced to because I had on a cassette the two rock and roll albums, the compilation albums, and it was on one of those. It was also that was also the first place I heard Taxman, because I hadn't heard Revolver at that point, and I Got to Get You Into My Life as well. We're on there. And I think that mix of Hey Bulldog was very different, to the extent that when I heard later mixes, there was sort of the bit where the riff is initially starts off with the piano and is then overlaid by guitar and then by the bass. So however it was mixed was not mixed in quite that way, so that the riff, particularly when it came back after the chorus, was it was nowhere near as strong. It didn't hit as hard. And then when I heard sort of later mixes, the mix that they did on the Yellow Submarine song track, and which I think is probably the same mix that you hear on the Blu-ray that we watched, that slaps, as the young people say. Like it's
yes, it does.
Like I say, that layering of three instruments playing the same riff and then just being layered one on top of each other, it really, really goes for it. I love it.
It's funny because it reminds me a little bit of early Beatles tracks, which were very much focused on a riff. You know, like you think of like Day Tripper and I Feel Fine.
Yeah.
You know, like the thing, when you're learning guitars, like some of the first guitar things you learn to play, like those kind of riffs, it reminds you of that. But then you also have this brilliant fun element that comes into the song later on, where you have these voices coming in the background and obviously dogs barking in the back.
Yeah.
And my favourite part in the whole song is just after the guitar solo, where John comes back in and says, "Big man." And you have a voice going, answering him. It's just fantastic. But like, so you kind of had this mix of, oh, here's like a really riff focused song, the kind of song that they kind of stopped doing around that period, because riffs by nature are relatively simple. So you had this sort of like simple approach to a song, which is all focused around one riff. But then they've also brought with it like the confidence of a band that can also just have fun in the studio while they're recording it. And that's what stands it apart from just being the kind of song that Teenage Fan Club might play, for example.
Yeah. It's so much fun. Like they're just mucking about so much. And all that. I think the bits at the end, where I think it's just John and Paul in singing into the same microphone and just ad-libbing those shouts and hollers at the end. There's a bit where, again, like it was only with later mixes that I could hear it properly, where into that Paul shouts, "Don't ask me, man, I only have 10 children." and it just means nothing in context at all. But he's just mucking about and making stuff up, I think. There was a bit in, I think maybe this was Ian McDonald as well, where I read that book so much when I was a teenager, so like bits of this are just really imprinted on my brain, where he said that the lyric that John initially brought along was, "Some kind of innocence is measured out in news." And he says, McCartney wisely pretended to have misread it and said measured out in you. I mean, how can he possibly know that that's how that happened?
That's interesting, isn't it?
Like, that's an odd thing to say. But I mean, to be perfectly honest, it wouldn't have made that much difference, I don't think. The whole thing is it's nonsensical. Have you heard, like, there is the demo of John just playing the "You Can Talk to Me" bit on a piano, and it's quite slow.
No, I haven't heard that, I think.
Yeah, and he's just got the chords and the little descending bit, and that's all he's got, basically. And I think the rest of it was all kind of figured out in the studio.
Love that stuff. I love the idea of it being fun and them just having fun with it as well, because that reminds me that I'd read something about Only a Northern Song, about how Paul had said that his dad used to have a trumpet, and it was like, he says that he could never play a trumpet, but he's going to have fun with one on this song, because it was that kind of song that allowed him the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
So you just have this sort of mad like trumpet wailing at the end of that song, because Paul's like, well, this, he's, I think he describes the song as being quite cheeky, So it's like it allowed him that freedom to just mess about on a trumpet, as you do when you're Paul McCartney, and, you know, and you've been given someone else's song.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So now that we've actually covered off the songs and the album, let's talk about the plot, the story. What little or loads of it there is, I'm still not entirely sure, to be honest with you. So, I mean, let's go through it. So first of all, we have Pepperland, that is being ambushed by Blue Meanies, who hate music. They encase the bandstand band in a blue globe to prevent them from playing music, and they attack all of the residents of Pepperland with various arrows and flying gloves and sparks and lightning and stuff to turn them all into statues, drain the colour of Pepperland. But luckily, young Fred, or old Fred, as the Beatles later referred to him as, is able to escape up a pyramid into a submarine, travel very, very far all the way to the Mersey in Liverpool, where he stumbles upon Ringo, meets the Beatles, convinces them to come back and save the residents of Pepperland from the Blue Meanies. Up until the point where they get to Pepperland, roughly how far into the film are we?
Oh, about two-thirds.
And then they just save the day.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there's a lot of journeying here. You can look at it one way in that they're journeying on the Yellow Submarine. The film's called Yellow Submarine.
In many ways, the real Yellow Submarine was the Yellow Submarine they met along the way.
Exactly. No, the actual journey that they take to Pepperland, like in narrative terms, you would expect it to take up less of the film, because the idea is that there's, to the extent there's conflict and resolution here, the conflict is that Pepperland has been taken over by the Blue Meanies, the Beatles are the heroes, they need to go and rescue them. So you would expect it to be more like them journeying to Pepperland is like there's the odd obstacle to overcome to get there, but generally they'll get there, and then the main obstacles are actually defeating the Blue Meanies in Pepperland. It's not that so much. It is more that getting there in the first place through various seas and through various creatures is sort of where the challenge is for them, and then when they get to Pepperland, it's actually quite easy to defeat them.
Yeah, I mean, can I be so bold as to draw an unlikely comparison?
Sure. But
genuinely, one I was thinking of while watching the film was, it's a little bit like Homer's Odyssey. Because it's a quest film, isn't it? It's the like you say, the journey they go on. I don't know if I can quite draw too many parallels to that as a text. I don't know if Jeremy Hillary Boob is supposed to be Telemachus or the Blue Meanies the Cyclops. I have no idea, but it feels like that. It feels like it's a journey story, a quest story that is steeped in the characters they meet along the way, the growth that happens along along that journey in order to then get to the destination, and the pacing is different in those kinds of stories.
Yeah.
You know, it is about the journey. It is about the people they meet along the way. Maybe it would make more sense if I, instead of referring to Homer's Odyssey, I referred to Ulysses 3001.
Yeah, of course. In many ways, the key text.
The 80s cartoon series.
Yes.
Based on the same source material. But yeah, it's, you know, it's similar. It's the journey is the framework for what is a series of episodic encounters.
Mm.
And I think that's what the film ultimately is.
Yeah.
Them getting to Pepperland and defeating Blue Meanies is kind of just the conclusion of that journey. It's not the usual rules of storytelling of like three acts and plot beats and things don't apply here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also that you, because there's this obstacle for them to overcome or a villain for them to defeat, but as ever in lots of Beatles narrative films, as characters, the Beatles are sort of quite disconnected from the task they have at hand, you know. So in Help, we spoke about how their lives are at risk. Like, literally, they are being pursued by a death cult, but they don't seem that bothered. They're just kind of having a laugh, really, which completely fits with the tone of that film. And this is similar, where Fred turns up in Liverpool with the Yellow Submarine and he sort of begs Ringo for help. And Ringo is sort of quite dismissive of him in general,
yeah.
And can't really be bothered.
Well, he actually says is, help, I need somebody, help. And then Ringo says, be specific. Which really generally made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. When he gets into their house and sort of meets them all, they're all, so, you know, George in particular is not very bothered. And, like, you know, there's the first shot you see of George, well, not the first shot, but like after you've seen him on the top of the mountain thing, where he's sort of being introduced as the one who's into Indian stuff, you know.
The spiritual one.
And then he sort of drives along in the car, and there's a look that George gives him that is just one of complete disdain, where it's like completely dismissive of the fact that this guy is in trouble. Now, obviously, this is, and I'm sure this won't be the last time we say this, but like, this is an animation, and in animations, you get away with much more. You're not expected to be entirely realistic. It would be stupid to expect that you were. That would misunderstand it. But as heroes, they are quite detached from the whole thing. The idea of them having to expend any particular effort to overcome this problem is not really the point of it. It's not really part of it, you know. So it's there's a similar thing in Give My Regards to Broad Street, but that's really just the product of it not being very well written, to be honest. Like, you know, or the product of Paul McCartney not really being capable of emoting when acting on his own, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a, I think with Hard Day's Night and Help, you've got this element of the story is what happens around the Beatles because they're in their own bubble of fame, and that heightens all of the spectacle and the chaos that happens around them. That's not present in Give My Regards to Wall Street. <That's>,
No,
that is just Paul just being a bit sort of lackadaisical in his approach to this massive dilemma. What do you think of the characterization of the Beatles as individuals? Because I have a few points. I don't know why Ringo's depressed when we first meet him. I don't know why he literally makes a joke about killing himself in the river. He says, I'll jump in the Mersey, but it looks like it's going to rain or something like that.
I know, but it looks like rain.
Oh, it looks like rain. That's right. Yeah. And then you have, so like you said before, I found it quite interesting actually that George was introduced to sitar music. Like, it felt like that was quite an early way to identify him. Like, this came out in 68. Like, I guess With In Without You had been released at that point, but it just felt, it was quite early for him to have that reputation as the spiritual one.
Yes, yeah, that's what I thought. And so the interesting thing is that I think the contract to do this, they sort of agree that, yes, you can go ahead with this Yellow Submarine film, is in the middle of 1967, so maybe just after the Sergeant Pepper release, I think, something like that.
It's 3 weeks after, I think.
3 weeks after.
Yeah, I think so,
The animations were done using the pictures of the Beatles from the Sergeant Pepper launch party at Brian Epstein's house, some of which would have been taken by Linda McCartney, I'm sure. So that, you know, that's why they're wearing the clothes they are in the thing. So it's really interesting. We talked earlier about this being a sort of snapshot in time, and like as ever with the Beatles' career, you take a snapshot of them and then you look away and look back again, and they've moved on and they're doing something completely different, and they've all grown beards or whatever, you know. So it's kind of taking a snapshot of this psychedelic era. But by 1968, by the time it's released, they're not done with it, you know what I mean? But they have kind of moved on, you know. So they're taking. I mean, one of the things about this film is it was done in 11 months, which is a ridiculously short period for an animation to be made in. I think Disney animations at that time were taking sort of roughly 4 years to produce. Mm. Getting one done in 11 months is crazy. If they'd had to do this, if they'd had 4 years in which to do this, I mean, obviously the Beatles would have split up by the time they had released it. But even if they hadn't, they would have moved on so much from the Beatles they were characterizing in that.
Yeah, you know? That's interesting. So, yeah, because like you say, 11 months is a ridiculously short period to make an animation.
Yeah.
But it's a ridiculously long period in terms of Beatles history.
Yes.
So I've actually got a note here. So the film was agreed in June 1967, which is a few weeks after Sgt. Pepper's was released. And it premiered in August 1968. So between June 1967 and August 1968, the band had recorded and had broadcast All You Need Is Love. They'd made the film and the album of Magical Mystery Tour. Brian Epstein died in August 1967. John met Yoko, Paul met Linda. The Apple Corporation was founded. And the group had made that trip to India to meet the Maharishi in February. And then they began the early beginnings of recording what eventually became the White Album. So yeah, so for all of that to happen at a time when an animation was being made based on their look promoting Sgt. Pepper's is actually quite problematic.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, the fact that by this point, we can sit and watch Yellow Submarine now, and as soon as George appears and it's set to the Indian music, we're like, ah, yep, George, he's the spiritual one. This characterizes him. But in 1968, when this was released, I suppose they'd been to India, but also when they started making this film, they hadn't been to India. So maybe that wasn't, they didn't even have that to rely on. So basically they're basing this on, this guy has done Love You Too and Within You Without You.
Yeah.
And that is enough of a specific thing about his personality to sort of serve as his characterization for this. You can see the sort of sad sack thing they've gone for with Ringo.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of played upon in both A Hard Day's Night and Help to some degree. And A Hard Day's Night in particular, the bit where he's walking around on his own after like he's sort of run away from the rest of the band and he meets the kid and things like that. They're dealing with broad strokes in terms of character.
Yeah. Right?
So if you look at them, you know, the cute one, the quiet one, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you look at Ringo, you can take that kind of, that fact that he has a slightly deadpan sense of humour and that he has that, as we've discussed in a previous episode, has that sort of resting sad face.
Yeah.
So it's easy to sort of draw a character like that where he's a bit sort of down on his luck, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and the characterisation of Paul and John, it's less obvious. You kind of get the impression that Paul is a bit sort of pleased with himself.
I think Paul is... when we first meet Paul, he's celebrating a classical concert. He's coming off stage. He's holding a bunch of flowers.
That's it, yeah.
And I guess there's a romanticized view of Paul, which I think is true at the time, this idea of him being like the cute one.
Yeah.
The bit that I kind of struggled with was John. And I think John is presented in this as like the intellectual.
Yes.
But intellectual in what I kind of think of as being the wrong way, not intellectual as a poet or as a philosopher, but an intellectual who spouts Einstein's theory of relativity. Doesn't feel like it's quite chiming with the right sense of intellectual.
No, that's true.
That John is normally associated with.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I wonder if he was thought of a little bit that way, especially because he'd written the two books by that point.
Yeah,
I suppose he was the one who in interviews, like people were aware, had a bit more of sort of literary bent to him, you know, like having written the books. And I think he would certainly talk in interviews about things he'd read and things like that, you know. So I think, yeah, maybe it comes from that.
Yeah.
It comes from that, you know. There's something that one of the members of the crew said, I can't remember where I heard it, but they said that the way they're animated is that all four Beatles have very specific ways of walking. And, you know, Ringo sort of trudges and John kind of struts, I think, you know. So that was deliberately done. So they weren't just kind of, you know, stop. It'd be quite easy just to animate them all just based on the same physicality with a different head on.
Yeah, makes sense, you
know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, but I think, you know, it's nice that things like this were thought about, Because actually, I suppose, like, animation, I mean, animation has been around for, you know, decades by this point, but perhaps it's sort of in its infancy in terms of presenting things like this to an adult audience.
Yeah.
And so perhaps making choices around characterization. Actually, no, I mean, to say that implies that there's no characterization in animation for children, which is rubbish. But I suppose maybe making specific character choices like that, it's another example of a Beatles product where they could have got away with doing a lot less.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, like, because I think that you'd like to think that those creative choices that were made at that time is what has directly led to this film standing the test of time. Because I think some of the creative minds behind this film had worked on a previous Beatles TV show,
yeah,
which no one knows and no one remembers, right?
I think in America it's quite well remembered. Okay. Yeah, I think the cartoon, I've never seen it, but I think the cartoon, which was just called The Beatles, that was a sort of Saturday morning kids cartoon, yes, where they would have sort of knockabout romps.
But the look of Yellow Submarine is one of five instantly recognisable Beatles looks.
Yes.
You know, like that design of them as characters is, you know, if you were to go through their entire career and try to, like, picture the Beatles at certain points, the Yellow Submarine would be one of them,
yeah,
even though it is a film that they actually had very little to do with.
Yeah.
Submitted their song offcuts for use and filmed, like, a, you know, couple of minutes live action bit at the end of the film.
Yeah.
But it is so recognisable as part of the Beatles' career, that look, that design element, and the overall look and feel of them animated as characters, but also obviously the Yellow Submarine look and shape.
Yeah.
And you'd like to think that, yeah, some of those deliberate creative choices early on is what has led to this having longevity.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I feel like the way that the accents are done, so the Beatles did not voice the characters themselves, there were actors doing it, and they are sort of exaggerated Scouse accents in a couple of cases, with Ringo and Paul, they're sort of pretty good impersonations. The John and George ones are just sort of more generic Scouse. But I feel like the voices used in Yellow Submarine to depict how the Beatles talk has gone on to be the template for how people do the general Beatles impression.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of generic way of talking like this, you know, the sort of drawl, and, you know, all that. Bits of it are taken from the way the Beatles speak, but I think in particular, there's a bit in it where they say, oh, they do though, don't they though? Yeah, they do though, don't they? And that's in like Harry Enfield and Sons, the Scousers used to do that. And I think I actually, yeah, I would have seen that Harry Enfield before I saw Yellow Submarine. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's where they got that from, you know. And that has just entered into the general vernacular of, like, oh, this is how Liverpudlians talk.
It's funny that you talk about it as being like a generalized version of that, because one of the facts that comes out about this film, if you do any kind of digging at all, is that the guy who voiced George was actually arrested halfway through production of the film. The guy's name is Peter Batten. He voiced George for the first half of the film and then was arrested because he was discovered to be a deserter from the British Army of the Rhine in West Germany.
Yeah.
So for the second half of the film, the guy who voices George is just the guy who voiced Ringo as well.
Yep.
Paul Angelus, who also did the voice of the opening narrator and the Chief Blue Meanie, but yeah, was cast as Ringo. And it was probably just like, well, we'll just do the same voice for George. It's fine. It's all basically the same voice.
Yeah, yeah. And Paul Angelus has another Beatles connection. His brother, Michael Angelus, took over the narration of Thomas the Tank Engine after Ringo stopped doing it in the early 90s.
I mean, they're all just using the same voice, aren't they?
pretty much. When's our Thomas the Tank Engine episode?
Whenever we can watch the 6,000 episodes in time to really do it justice.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found really interesting, actually, about the film is that it introduces this idea of there being a deeper plot thread at play that isn't necessarily on the surface. And there's a reading of this film, which is that the Beatles, even though they have been discovered by young Fred to help come to Pepperland and defeat the Blue Meanies, that actually not only have they been to Pepperland before, but were the originators of that land, and that the residents there kind of all descend from the Beatles.
Yeah.
Bear with me.
Okay.
Right? So let me go walk through this. So first of all, when they travel to Pepperland, there is a moment in the film where they look out the window of the yellow submarine and they see an identical yellow submarine with identical Beatles in that.
Yep.
And they talk about how, because they're traveling through the sea of time, that is them on a different timeline to the one they're currently on.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Never mentioned again.
Yeah.
Right? When they get to Pepperland, the Lord Major, who is has been trapped under a big pile of green apples, when he sees them for the first time, he sort of like touches their face and says, "Oh, you look just like the originals."
Mm.
And later on in the film, when they free the band from the bandstand, they are doubles for the Beatles.
Yeah.
So I think there's this kind of underlying idea that they have somehow initiated Pepperland themselves. I don't, tell me, am I approaching this from a too much of a sci-fi geek
angle? No, not at all. No, I think it's funny, like in describing that to me, you've reminded me of, I think, two episodes of Red Dwarf.
Yes, exactly.
So the one, you know, it's the episode of Red Dwarf where they find, like, there's like a mirror image ship of them where, like, there's one ship where everything's good and the other where everything's
yes,
bad.
Yeah,
or maybe...
Angels and Demons.
Yeah, or maybe they, the one where they meet the sort of future echoes of themselves or whatever it is.
Yeah, future echoes, it's called.
Yeah, and there is the other one where, also just the general concept where, like, everyone is descended from... there's an entire species descended from cats because these cats have evolved over.
So basically, Yellow Submarine, very much in many ways, like Red Dwarf.
Yeah. Dave Lister's from Liverpool, isn't he? It all fits.
By Michael and Paul's third brother.
Anyway, sorry, we've gone off topic a bit. But yes, so I think, it's like there's a reading of it whereby, I don't know, I like the idea that there are alternative readings of it, because there always should be alternative readings of everything, because it's what makes things interesting. Mm. Like, you know, like you know that thing when you're a kid and you're doing Shakespeare at school, and like the teacher says, "Oh, this is all the symbolism in this," and like, and you turn to your mate and say, "Oh, symbolism! I bet he didn't know any about this when he was writing it." You know,
yeah, and Shakespeare, no, really,
yeah, exactly. You know, and which misses the point, as like, you know, as teenage literary appreciation often does. because the idea is not whether the author meant it. There is still value in interpreting things in different ways. I think, you know, so yeah, even something like Yellow Submarine, which is on the face of it a sort of silly knockabout caper, can absolutely be read in that way.
It feels a little bit like you placating me, but I think I'll take it.
I mean, a bit, yeah, sure.
I do feel like there is a, in my mind, the Beatles are almost like Prometheus type figures for Pepperland. I think that also plays out in the way that the story unfolds, with them having otherworldly abilities and powers in dealing with the Blue Meanies.
Yeah.
When they get there, like, they aren't troubled by Blue Meanies. They don't panic. They don't, you know, as you said before, there's a disassociative quality to them as characters in the film.
Yeah.
They know how to handle that situation, and at no point do they seem like they're in peril.
Yeah.
And I think as a result, the film presents them as being on a different level to the other characters that we see in the film, which are, I guess, more normal. You know, I think that they're put on a little bit of a pedestal. And you could argue that pedestal gives them sort of the veneer of this sort of like superhuman quality to them.
Yeah,
which absolutely plays into my theory of them as godlike characters, originators yep. of the natives of Pepperland.
Yep.
Go on.
Yes. And no. It reminds me, actually, what you're saying of in Magical Mystery Tour, the sequence with the wizards, where, they, as accidental as that may have been, the wizards are these characters who are directing the narrative or observing the narrative in some way and like wanting to exert some kind of control over it, be that sort of benign or malign. But they, the Beatles sort of accidentally, or the wizards in Magical Mystery Tour are accidentally maybe portrayed as sort of divine figures almost. And yes, you can see in, I suppose you can see, I would more equate them to sort of superheroes than, which obviously it does suggest a sort of supernatural state, but superheroes are perhaps a bit more grounded in reality, or at least that's the way that that Marvel movies will play them now. It's like, even if they're aliens like Thor, they will still like sit and, you know, and eat shawarma with you know, that kind of thing. They're more grounded deliberately to sort of make them more real and more relatable, and just sort of more fun as well. So yeah, I think I would probably draw more of a parallel with superheroes than, you know, gods. Gods has gone a bit far.
Well, I mean, have you seen Superman? They basically say that he is a god.
Yeah,
Thor is a god.
Yeah,
Thunder. I'd like to see either of those two characters played with a thick Scouse accent.
Yeah.
No, but my last stretch of this argument to give is, it seems to me that the Beatles saving the day in the way that they do comes from their nature, which is different to the other characters portrayed on screen.
Yeah.
What we see on their journey to Pepperland is them frequently reaching out to other characters they meet, being kind, forming and forging friendships and relationships and building connections. And it's that sort of natural part of them as characters that helps them defeat the Blue Meanies. You know, it should have been obvious from the offset, but I did smile to myself when John beats the glove by just taking off the G and then singing All You Need Is Love.
Yeah.
And also right through to the end when Chief Blue Meanie is defeated and they reach out to him and build a connection with him and change that whole narrative. And that, you know, there's a reading of that which is almost like a religious teaching of how you should conduct yourself as a person to sort of, you know, be better and to save the day and to win out.
Yeah, there's an inclusivity to it. So, you know, enemies aren't defeated so much as just sort of persuaded to the cause.
Yes, yeah.
So it's quite a casual cause for sure in terms of the way it's played. But yes, definitely. Other than the bit where there's the sort of purple elephant guy and they all say how ugly he is, which I thought was an odd misstep. But yeah, you're right. Everyone they come into contact with, they are sort of gradually bringing them on board with their ethos. And it is peace and love. As it always is.
As it always is.
Yeah.
And you know what I like about that as well is I think, you know, when we were talking about the at the start of this episode and you were talking about having watched this in lockdown, like that idea of building connections and sort of this communal spirit that comes with the Beatles as characters feels very much in keeping with your experience of watching this at that time.
Yeah.
And I also like the fact that, you know, when we're talking about this film now, more than 50 years later, how relevant is it really to audiences now? It feels like it's extremely relevant for this film to have so much focus on unification and diversity.
Yeah.
And that diversity is explored with the characters and with those friendships that the Beatles makes along the way, but also in the huge range of styles of animation that is present in the film. Like this is a film that screams diversity in all aspects, which is something that we'll probably go on to explore in part two of our discussion on Yellow Submarine. I hope you have enjoyed listening to this first part. Please join us again next week for part two of our discussion. If you have enjoyed this episode, why not leave us a 5-star rating or a review on your podcast listening platform of choice? That would be much appreciated. And as always, you can reach us on all of the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. But otherwise, we will see you again next week for Yellow Submarine Part 2. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.